From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation about the film Hail County This Morning, This Evening. The unconventional documentary has been nominated for an Academy Award. The filmmaker Ramel Ross went to rural Alabama to Hail County, and he followed two young African-American men and their families. The film is not a conventional story. It's made up of images and moments. We'll be right back.
I'm Andrew Becker, the news director here at KUER. Our newsroom is growing, with new reporters set to join us in the coming months. In the meantime, we want to know, what issues should we be covering where you live? What stories should we be telling in your community? Help us improve our coverage of Utah by answering a few short questions. Go to KUER.org and click Community Feedback Form under the About tab.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. I really hope you will go online and watch the documentary film we're going to talk about today. But I want to get you ready for it, because this is one of those films that may challenge you. And I say this knowing it could scare a few of you away. The film is called Hail County, This Morning, This Evening. The filmmaker Ramel Ross follows two young black men in Hail County. This is in rural Alabama. One is hoping for a basketball scholarship. One is trying to make a living and take care of his energetic son. But the film doesn't really follow a conventional storyline. It's built out of moments, these long, slow passing shots, this frenetic time lapse, these fragments of death and birth and stars and rain. People in their community just existing, as Ross puts it. But don't think about it as an abstract, experimental film, because you'll easily be able to find the stories. It's just going to take patience and some attention. Ross says don't expect a message, but do expect an experience. Ramel Ross joined us to talk about the film. It's up for an Academy Award this weekend, and you can watch it right now online. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. Ramel Ross is an assistant professor at Brown University. He directed the film, wrote it, produced it, shot it, edited it, and he joined us from a studio in New York City. So right up front in a title, and I want to ask you about some of the other titles, some of which are funny and some of which are poetic, but the title kind of right up front, the discovering, you say, in the film, began after you moved to Alabama in 2009. And we'll talk about when you first went to Alabama and those sorts of things. But just explain what you mean by the discovering. It's such an interesting way to put it, the discovering.
Yeah, it's just a process of understanding things in general. And however vague that sounds, it's, you know, when you're young, or actually, you know, it happens at any point in your life when you are open to being changed and you're open to understanding and you're sort of pursuing learning, you know, in terms of conversation and, you know, types of choices you make, what you think, how other people think. You're constantly discovering. And so I think, you know, there's a variety of words that could have been used for that opening title, but discovering is such a sort of like playful and almost innocent use or word. So I think that's why specifically that was chosen.
When you went down into Alabama in 2009, the idea was to teach photography and to work with young people, coach basketball. Did you feel like you experienced that kind of openness, that you were open for some kind of discovery as you started to sort of look and see what was around you?
Yeah, I think I've sort of always been open to sort of discovering through experience. I had, you know, before I moved to Alabama, I was in D.C. And before that, I was living in Northern Ireland working with Catholic and Protestant youth in Northern, in Belfast. And I was also traveling with the State Department before that. And so I was kind of on the tail end of pretty consistent international travels and sort of learning about myself and the world through the, you know, intersection of the two. And so, yeah, a lot of it, I mean, and yeah, it's different to discover those types of things in your own backyard.
Why were you interested in working with young people?
You know, it just feels good. You know, there's, yeah. You know, and every person that is, everyone wants to be looked up to and to teach. You know, you often find, you know, siblings immediately going home and teaching their younger brother or sister what they learned that day or sharing information they have. Like the, in one sense, the point of information is to share it. And there are so many people that I've like learned from in my life, from my father to coaches that I've had. And so I kind of don't really know how to be in the world outside of helping other people or teaching or being in that sort of relationship where you're trying to excel or, you know, expedite someone else's progress, because that's kind of how I got to where I was.
So when you're down there, at first you're just taking photographs, I guess. And then at some point you start filming. In the documentary, when you started filming, it says that you started using, this is how you put it in a title card, using time to figure out how we've come to be seen. Explain that. Like, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's as much of a sort of prompt as it is a literal circumstance.
Yeah.
It's true in the sense that, you know, the longer you're with something, the more time you spend with something, the more you know it.
Yeah.
And it could be argued, you know, to, you know, if there's a philosopher listening or, well, you can also get to know something less the more that you're with it, because it becomes more complex and it becomes contradictory. And that's perhaps not the best way to engage with whatever it is, the most useful way. But, yeah, being there and, you know, sort of moving through your preconceptions, moving through your expectations, moving through the way in which you even think you can help, which I think was the first kind of slap in the face going there, was that, you know, we have certain ideas about how people can contribute and succeed in society, specifically those who are disenfranchised. Do this, you can do this, you can do this, you can do this, and this is how you get there.
Yeah.
And to go into a community and to be part of it, and then to sort of impose sort of an outside conceptual idea on how to change someone's life onto someone is a slap in the face, because it doesn't work. And so that's the process of time as well. Like, you're there, you're talking, you're engaging, and you're realizing over time that things aren't as simple as they seem. And you need to sort of reformulate your relationship to the place, which is letting the place and the folks speak to you. And then going from there, kind of listening, you know?
Yeah. You know, I have to say the experience going through the film myself, it was interesting. I sort of was tracking the way I was experiencing this. And at first I was like, I'm not sure, what is this at first? And then I had to just sort of settle back into it. Not think too much about it. Let the kind of imagery flow past me, because there's a lot of images that flow past.
Yeah.
Right? There's a lot of lyrical, to me anyway, lyrical movement. And once I settled into that, then I could fully experience it. But I was resisting at first because I wanted it to be a quote-unquote documentary, even though I know it is a documentary, and we'll talk about that. But like, it was hard for me to sort of peg what this was. But once I settled into it, then it just became kind of an experience.
Yeah. So hard to do.
Yeah.
And also
yeah.
Hard to engage with, right? Because we're so – and this has to do with going to the South and, you know, meeting people and having relationships. We're like – we're very conditioned to do things in certain ways. One of them is watch films.
Yeah.
And so in trying to create an experience of my experience, an experience of Daniel and Quincy's lives, an actual experience of the historic South as much as possible. You know, you kind of have to, which was one challenge of the film, is like, how do you sort of teach or encourage some way to watch the film, to engage with this language, yeah, so that a person can release the expectations of, you know, narrative or a specific type of character exchange and just like watch and then be kind of taken in.
Yeah. How did you come up with it? Did you did this idea of it just being this experience, did that come to you before you started putting it together, or as you were looking at these images and looking at color and movement and the idea of meaning? I mean, like, at what point did it come into the form that it has, I guess?
It was about 5 months into the process of shooting the film. It's like really early 2012, or actually mid-2012, that the sort of, I knew the form of the film, but the problem was obviously, you know, you need to capture the moments to fill in the form, which I thought would actually take 10 years about. Mm-hmm. But it only took five. Yeah, kind of the form and the idea of the experience came from looking at footage from 5 months of shooting and making a sort of, as most documentary filmmakers would make, making a traditional film, making a film out of that, and me just being extremely disappointed with what I imagined its, you know, capacity to connect with an audience. And so going, looking through all of that footage and sort of intuitively pulling out moments that I felt had some sort of unique beauty to them or some specific beauty to them, and then putting those on the timeline and then kind of intuitively just making a cut out of those that was super short and being like, oh my gosh, like this is just seemingly just as meaningful, if not more meaningful than that previous cut, if that cut was successful, but yet it's unfamiliar and seemingly flexible, you know? And so that was kind of where the idea of the film was born, the full idea.
One of the things I've heard you say was that you were kind of adamant you didn't want quote unquote scenes, like a beginning, middle, and an end of a scene.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, there are a couple of moments here I want to mention. I'm hoping we can just talk about some moments without kind of diminishing their, you know, like cheapening them by talking about certain moments, because I think they have to be experienced in some ways. But there's, yeah, this moment where we see, I think it's Daniel, it may not be because we don't see their face, but where they're bouncing a ball and it's after a workout or in the middle of, and they're sweating, and so their sweat is dropping onto the dry pavement. And then you transition right after that into rain dropping onto dry pavement.
Yeah.
Would you talk about that experience and how that makes up the feel of the film and it not being a conventional, you know, scene?
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things that's, you know, it is what it is because it language fails it, you know?
Yep.
And if language didn't fail it, then we wouldn't be talking about it in some sense.
Right.
And so, you know, when that moment like, I played a lot of sports, a lot of basketball. The drill that Daniel was doing was a drill that I've done, which is, you know, kind of the defensive position, and you're just like pounding the ball with one hand for a certain amount of time. And, you know, you fall into this sort of mechanic, meditative state. You know, you're really conscious of your, you know, the way in which your muscles are being taxed, to your heartbeat, to your breath. This everything is extremely physical, but yet you're also kind of completely automated. And in those moments, I definitely remember looking. You sometimes just become fixated on one dot or one piece of grass or one cloud while you're, you know, doing this thing for a minute or two. So I remember looking at just my sweat dropping often. You know, and these are things that just become, you know, noted in your memory or in your experience. And it's not something that you consider to be art or you consider to have some sort of other value aside from it being the extinguishing of your, you know, your fluids in this, yeah. you know, whatever sort of way. And then I'm filming Daniel, and, you know, I see that, and it's such a, one, a marker, but also symbolically and kind of like physiologically, the squeezing of the labor. It's just like there's something incredibly human about single drops of sweat dropping off. And so, you know, got that moment. Didn't think much of it aside from that. I knew that it was going to be in the film because I thought it was a unique shot. And then, you know, 2-3 months later, I'm at Daniel's friend's house and it starts raining. You know, I go outside, I'm shooting, and I look down at the ground, and it just like you see the exact same thing. And people sometimes ask me how, you know, some of the shots and how things kind of end up relating to each other and connecting. And I tell them that if you look carefully at your footage, and you're sort of really invested in the formal elements of the way in which you shoot, and you find ones that you like, you tend to go out and shoot that same way. Like, you pursue matching something that you were happy with before, and sometimes it's a problem. Sometimes it's not a problem. But for this, I kind of saw the exact same, you know, form, and then, you know, I captured that. And then when I put both on the timeline, I was like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
This is kind of what it's all about. Like, this is where words fall apart. And people are really in it, you know?
Yeah. I was really surprised by and kind of taken with how important, and I don't even know if you technically had an audio designer, but the audio design to me in this was really important. And there's this, for example, there's this scene where we see these cheerleaders doing this kind of routine where they're doing this woo, and it seems so rhythmic and it appears in another place, and it might even appear in two other places. And I'm not sure if you placed it there, but I thought – I kept referring back to it, and I loved that connection, and I liked the idea that sound was such an important part of all of this too.
Yeah. Well, it's very much about in just a loose, you know, sort of spontaneously speaking way, the idea of – memory and just like human experience, you know, and human experience, it is a pattern, you know, like in our own lives, we're composed of patterns and our consciousness is a pattern. And there's just so many ways in which we need to refer to the past in order to participate in the future. And that happens with, you know, smells for memory and sounds for safety. And so, you know, during the sound design part of the film, which was really extensive and something that was completely new to me. You know, the film was built visually,
yeah.
And I had an on-camera mic and got really good sound of everything that I encountered, but it was all incredibly perspectival so that, you know, when someone walks away, they trail away,
yeah.
Wasn't very full. But when we're designing the sound, myself, this guy, Dan Timmons, who is an amazing sound designer, he went back to Hell County with me and we picked up a bunch of sound. Then also Tony Valente, who's another incredible, they call him an owl because he just hears things that aren't supposed to be heard by humans.
Right.
But we're in the sound design space. We're like, how do we give the film its own memory? You know, like how do we give it its own experience? How do we make things recursive? How do we mimic life? How do we do the things that we sort of take for granted? And it sounds like, you know, abstract and existential, but it's really just a matter of being keen to the way in which things influence things, you know?
Yeah. Ramel Ross, his documentary is called Hale County, this evening. The film is up for an Oscar this weekend in the Best Documentary Feature category, and you can go watch it online right now for free. It's hosted by PBS's Independent Lens. There's a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Support for KUER comes from the local and national businesses around the state that underwrite our programming. Shows like Morning Edition, Radio West, and All Things Considered. If your business or organization cares about the in-depth local news and fascinating conversations you can only find on public radio, team up with KUER. To learn more about becoming an underwriter, look for the support tab at KUER.org and click on Business Support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation about a film that's up for an Academy Award this Sunday night. It's called Hale County, This Morning, This Evening. It's a documentary, but not a conventional one. The director is Ramel Ross, who joined us from a studio in New York City. Is it a documentary? I mean, you say it is. In fact, that seems important to you. And this idea that I think a lot of people are going to treat it as an abstract kind of experimental thing, but that's not the way you want it to be thought of. And it's not really what it is, but I just wonder what you're thinking about where it fits.
Yeah. I want it to be a documentary so bad.
Yeah.
And it is.
Yeah.
That was one of the most important things. Yeah, I think it has to be a documentary. I don't think that there's honestly a more important space in art or in creation, simply because, which you know very well, and most people do, but they don't quite think about it, that the way in which it predisposes us for the encounter with truth. You know, when you're like on the subway and you look up and something happens, you're not thinking truth. You know, like when you're like with your family and something happens, you're not thinking truth. But when you watch a documentary, you're thinking truth, like you're prepared to engage with that. And so to me, like situating, you know, the Black experience, the historic South, whatever the Black experience is, it's a big thing.
Yeah.
The historic South, like Quincy and Daniel's lives with imagery that is not popularly used in the context of truth, like you can see them this way, you know, like you can see the world like this. It's not something that is unattainable and is going to be in some sort of, you know, closet in a museum because it's so distinctly off the normal span of or the normal purview of visuality. Like this is real life, you know?
Yeah.
And to me, that's very important because real life has not been experienced in terms of Black folks. It hasn't been experienced by the majority of America.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think the origins of that are you know clear. They're historical. There has to do with transatlantic slave trade and slavery. But I think even more sinisterly, simply because, you know, when those things were happening, the world was completely different. And, you know, there were a lot more intellectually justice-oriented people after there was after slavery ended, post-civil rights movement, though that's a continuous thing, who participate in sort of the media production or the production of sort of false reality experiences through news and through cinema and through photography that are just as damning to the nation's understanding of the Black experience as, you know, sort of foreclosing someone inside sort of Black representational space. And so it's, to me, it's all about the imagery that goes out because the world is segregated. The country is segregated, you know, formally.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of places that aren't segregated, but the world is kind of segregated. The country is kind of segregated. And so if you're only feeding folks images that, you know, are tragically reductive, like what are they supposed to think? Like it's just the natural equation.
There's this storyline that you see in all the time in films about the African American experience, and it's something that you've called the struggle narrative.
Yeah.
And it made me think about like if someone were to say, oh, there's an element in the film Daniel who he has this dream, I guess you could put it, this idea that he wants to make the team, and in college, he has big ideas about possibly having a basketball career. But this is not hoop dreams like this documentary. And I just wanted to get a sense of how you see the difference. Like, what are the limitations of this idea of the struggle narrative? Not to say anything bad about the film Hoop Dreams, but this is not that.
No, I like really love Hoop Dreams.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, me too.
it's a really good film, and it's like a needed film, you know. And we also need other films like Hoop Dreams. But my concern is that a lot of films are only hoop dreams. And so when you don't have when a film is made by a person of color with, you know, the resources and, you know, as a filmmaker that's not a filmmaker of color, and they're representing that community, they tell a completely different story.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's simply because the experience is more familiar. And so you have a different perspective on the way to articulate it, or there are certain modes of representation or modes of analysis that, you know, you kind of want to share or you want to explore. There's like this thing that happens when a lot of folks watch the film where they're like, oh my gosh, like the imagery was incredibly intimate, and you had such, some of the shots were so beautiful, blah, 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 which I really appreciate because, that is partly the goal. But I like to talk about that, and this relates to the sort of struggle narratives and the hoop dream comparison, is that when I'm filming a person like similar to myself, my familiarity with them is so historical and so nuclear family that I'm not satisfied with a certain type of imagery.
Yeah.
And I'm not satisfied with a certain type of distance. But when you're not, you don't have that relationship, you know, being 3 feet from someone and getting that image, like, to, you're like, oh, man, God, I got it. That's great. I got it, you know? But to me, I'm like, oh, that's not even close to it. It is, like, a lot close, or it's more like this, because I'm more familiar, you know? And I think the history of imaging people of color, black folks specifically, have suffered, and in the U.S. at least, has suffered from sort of that, in which people are satisfied with what they have, but that's incredibly reductive and kind of double down on the othering and the distancing.
It gets to something that you had said. Like, there's a moment, there was this moment where there are the three young African-American girls. I can't even quite tell exactly what they're doing. They're like rehearsing a song or something. And we see it from a distance. Like, you're way off. And we can't – it's not up close. Mm-hmm. And yet I can hear it. It kind of – it's beautifully recorded in terms of the audio, I have to say. And then in the distance, occasionally you'll see a flash of lightning. Mm-hmm. So it's beautiful. And their voices are beautiful. As they're rehearsed, I don't have a context for it, but I don't really need it. But I found it beautiful, mm-hmm. and it made me think of something that Du Bois had talked about: that in order for black work to escape this label of blackness, it has to be, as he put it, beautiful enough for it not to be reduced. But, so, would you just talk about that? Because the idea
is that what Du Bois said.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's amazing. I didn't know. I've read a bunch of Du Bois. I have never come across that line. I quote Darby English from his book How to See an Artwork in Total Darkness, or something along those lines, which is an incredible, incredible exploration of black visuality and black representational space. But what he says, which is the exact same thing but in different language, which I share all the time, is that in order for a work to, you know, it has to be formally beautiful in order for it to transcend black representational space.
Yeah.
It has to be so formally grand and almost grandiose that you have to contend with it on a formal level.
Right.
And if you contend with it on a formal level, then you're sort of out of the social in some sense, you know?
Yeah.
I'm really excited that you brought that up. That's kind of one of the core values of the film, as I'm sure you can imagine, which is, you know, there's tons of stuff that we left on the editing floor because all the content was there, the moment was wonderful, but there it just wasn't quite confrontingly beautiful enough.
Right. Right.
And with that moment of those girls standing out there singing, yeah, there's something incredible about them being silhouetted. There's something incredible about, you know, one being so far off that it doesn't seem like they're performing, that they even know the camera's there, mm-hmm. and they're completely immersed in an atmosphere that is as palpable as any atmosphere, because we all know the impending storm or the wake of the storm, and, you know, the smells and just the idle time that you spend as a young person enjoying your friends and enjoying a shared moment. I was floored that that happened.
Yeah. I want to ask, there's a scene that I wanted to ask you about, and it's a cotton field. It's this epic tracking shot of a cotton field, and I wanted to ask you about it, because one of the things you've talked about is that you don't particularly like shooting cotton. I guess you're kind of like don't like it at all, but like because it's such a what? It's such, I think you called it a platitude. It's just kind of this dead idea.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the way you chose to shoot it in the film, because this moment is, it's another really beautiful moment, and it has this kind of lyricism to it, and it really takes its time. Mm-hmm. Would you talk about that moment?
Yeah, it's so fascinating too, because I wasn't going to shoot that. The co-editor on the film is a really fascinating and incredible artist and professor and critic and language person, Maya Krinsky. And, you know, she has a co-writer credit because, she sort of was there at the beginning of the film. And, you know, we were working through imagery and talking about things and understanding how some of these ideas can be executed. And so this cotton field moment was shot within the first year, and I remember, you know, passing by it and, you know, taking a picture of it and sending it to Maya and being like, man, I just can't shoot the cotton field. I just can't do it, for all the reasons that you mentioned. And, you know, she's like, shoot it, because, you know, you don't shoot things like other people, and so just shoot it. And so the only way I could imagine getting the scale of that thing is to trace along its longest path. It's super simple. Like, I'm like trying to think of how to make it more interesting. But it's like, you know, you just kind of film the cotton field from the car on the tripod, and yeah, it becomes devastating. Yep. When it doesn't end.
There are moments in the film that you capture this this tension. I'm thinking of one in the locker room. Mm-hmm. Daniel is nervously pacing. It's like he's apart from the rest of the guys in some ways. Mm-hmm. I have to say, it gave me a sense of the stakes for him. And some of the other players are just, they're messing around, right? They're getting ready for the game. But there's such tension, like there was such pent-up energy. There's such kind of sparring. There's a lot of like testosterone floating around in there, and then it gets sort of spent. And there's, I don't know, would you just talk about that particular moment? And then in the meantime, Daniel's just sort of pacing back and forth, but it had a kind of, I don't know, pent up kind of tension for me. I thought it was a kind of an intense scene.
Yeah, it's quite strange. And I say strange specifically, like looking at it through the camera as it's happening.
Yeah, yeah.
Is even stranger than just looking at it through the camera, you know, because, you know, there's this unsolvable question, which is like, is reality inscribed by the photograph, or is the photograph inscribed by reality? Like, we've come into a point where they're so inextricable, you know? And so being able to like see something that has that power that most often is only seen framed in that way, but then being able to look at that frame and then see its sort of wider reality is like a real bizarre, it's like the it was almost like a paradox in some weird way. Yeah, I love that moment for a variety of reasons, specifically because it acts as, to me, that scene and Kyrie running scene as the clearest sort of like Rorschach test for your experience with the folks moment.
Yep.
Because there's so much content and there's so much personality and character. And it's all, as you mentioned, couched in this sort of teeming that seems like it's going to boil or overflow, but just seems to just continue to transfer back and forth between people, you know, without any sort of logic. Though, of course, there's like an overarching structure or something to it. But I like that you said it sort of spoke to Daniel's stakes because he is all about business in that moment and is really trying to make sure that he uses this moment, this next game, as a stepping stone to his larger goals.
We should say, so Quincy, Kyrie is Quincy's son. And
yeah.
And that scene that you referred to is extraordinary. Like, this kid, man, such energy. And it almost seemed like it was a time lapse. You know what I mean? Almost like, man, that can't be real. Because everything else behind him is just static. It's just sort of sitting there. But Kyrie is on the go. I loved that moment, too, because that's expressed, I think, a lot of where, frankly, Quincy's perspective seemed to be coming from.
Yeah. And that moment comes right before the gym moment, too, you know?
Yep.
And so, you know, there's so many ways to talk about the film. And I think, obviously, I think that's a good thing. It was built to be an open book with a lot of intentional sentences and poems and stuff. But I think I love talking about that Kyrie moment in terms of wondering how his energy, once he gets to a classroom setting, will be dealt with.
Yep.
You know, you see this kid, he's lovable, he's smart, he's on the brink of speaking, and he is uniquely energetic. And maybe one doesn't think that he's uniquely energetic, but I know Kyrie from spending much of time with him, and most of the footage I have of him is of him running like that.
Right.
And so, you know, a lot of youth find their a way to sort of expel their energy, make use of it in sports, as you can kind of see through the next scene. But what is the future of this guy? You know, like what's going to happen? What happens to the hyper energetic young black fella in schools?
You said this, that the way you show us Daniel and the way you show us Quincy in the film, we don't have a chance to judge them. Explain that.
Yeah, you know, there's this thing I realized at some point about films and about, you know, people and moments. And like the moment that you sort of see someone making a decision, like you see them, you know, choose to like shoot their they like finish their drink and they have their bottle and they choose to shoot it into a trash can and they miss. And, you know, that's like, you're like, whoop, they shouldn't have done that. You know, like there's something fundamentally judgy about the human brain as it looks at other people making decisions and moving through the world. And then you sort of somehow leap from there to that a lot of people are in control of their destiny and their choices that they make, from throwing that bottle into the trash can to when to cross the street to how early that they should leave for work. Like, these are the decisions that determine whether or not they're successful or not successful. And, you know, that is the language of pull yourself up by your bootstraps,
yep.
Like make better decisions.
Yep.
And most films that have black folks in it have a bunch of moments of judgment, and to moments of possible judgment, they're all composed of moments of possible judgment, which
yep.
is part of narrative and story. Narrative and story are wholly necessary and wonderful means of meaning making and sharing histories and whatnot. But there's an element of that that traps someone in someone else's judgment, regardless of how empathetic the character depiction is, regardless of how wonderful the film is. There's something fundamentally non-universally relatable to that because of the way in which we judge. And so what happens when you remove those decisions? You know, what happens when you're forced to contend with someone on a sheer visual level in moments of relative awe or moments of banal beauty? What do you think? You know, and that's where you get to, that's where I think a person can be challenged to get to know how they believe in the world or believe in people.
Yeah. I think I felt like that's why this film is so deeply personal for people experiencing it, because you have to contend with all of that yourself. Yeah. Like, what are the judgments I'm making or have made, or what are the conclusions I'm coming based on? So in that sense, it's a really personal experience to watch the film.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like, that was a big, I want to say choice. There's like a better word. A big goal was to, how do you increase the sort of intersubjective experience? Like, how do you force like complete and or encourage like projection, you know, as opposed to just take that as the default and continue to feed? Like, how do you open it up to like force or to cajole someone into throwing their imagination and their life experiences into consecutive, you know, sequential moments? You remove narrative, you know, and you remove information and you offer the visual, you know, and you sort of offer the audio and yeah.
I want to ask you about Mary. This is Daniel's mom. There were times when I was like, this film's about Mary, right? Like, this is not about Daniel and Quincy. This is about Mary and about Boozy too, which is Quincy's girlfriend. But say something about Mary. She's such a, I don't know, I loved her. She was so fascinating.
Yeah, Mary's so fascinating. She is, you know, she became, and this is, it's strange. This is like the footage completely speaking. And not that the footage doesn't speak in every film, but, you know, some films it speaks more. And, you know, after filming for 3 years, you know, talking with Maya a bunch about Mary, like she emerged as, like the unspoken kind of like presence in the entire film. It was really weird. She's like there, not there, in Boosie 2, in which, you know, the film is like shaped by their absence in some sense,
right?
You know? But she's such a sort of church-going, faith driven woman that it's quite beautiful at times to be around her, because she really is connected to something outside of our daily lives as a coping mechanism on one sense, but also as you know, a way to sort of believe that, you know, the world is more than the offerings that she's had.
How did you There's a scene where you're talking to her, and then she's, I think it's her daughter right there, right? She's trying to get her to say her name. But it's just such a kind of great moment that seems so just out of nowhere, and there's no particular purpose to it necessarily beyond it just being her talking about how it gets really cold in the catfish plant.
Yeah.
And it's nice for her to take a break. And then it just sort of lingers. And I don't know, I just really, but I'm just wondering how you got that. Like, because it seemed to me that, and this was true for a lot of moments that just happen, where where Quincy nods off in the delivery room, for example. Like, were
I love
you,
that moment.
Oh, I do too. And you have to be there. Like you had to be there for a lot of – I mean, they had to, I guess, sort of stop thinking about you being present. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I think that's like one of the things that I like to talk about with filmmakers and, you know, those documentary filmmakers specifically about – what would happen if you made a film in a place that you would be anyway?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, what are the consequences? What are the consequences of culling meaning when you go to look for meaning and you have a time that you have to find it? You end up, like, you know, fulfilling your own expectations and, you know, fudging markers for meaning. But it's really interesting to join the lives of the people who you're making a film with or about, you know, as opposed to capture their lives. And when you do that, when you join the lives, you tend to not shoot only them. You, like, shoot everything because you're shooting from your experience of the world with them and not them in your experience of the world, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so that slight distinction, I think, is one just good in terms – just as like a concept. But I think in terms of the practical relationship between the folks that you're interested in telling the story of, they end up not thinking that, you know, it's – they're like stars or that, which they are in some sense, but like, yeah. It's not, you're not like only interested in them, like you're interested in everything. And there's something, I think, at least over time, relaxing about and non-confrontational and a little bit less stressful or performative about being around all the time and not always focusing on them, and then you just become a natural part of their life. Like, you join their world.
There's something that you've talked about, going back to Du Bois again, where he talks about lifting and lowering the veil.
Yeah.
And here's something you said about that, which I was really taken by. You said that it's that action, if I got this right anyway, that's going to save humanity.
Hmm.
What did you mean? Like that
oh, man, my friend gave me a lot of shit for that. I was like, because I'm so idealistic.
Yeah.
as you can tell by the film.
Yes.
He was like, come on. I'm like, no, but seriously, think about it. And then I went into this really long explanation. But yeah,
But you believe it.
I do. I really do. Like, I don't think that, you know, and I think there's arguments otherwise, but the people, I think, tend to not only hunker down on a point of view based on their life experience, which is quite natural, but I also think that they tend to forget that they've been trained in some sense to learn that, to be that way,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And in fact, most of the moments of their lives that they don't remember are the moments that shape them. And so to me, the lifting up and down of the veil in some sense is a constant reminder of the very narrow and singular perspective that we have, one, as an individual, two, as like a part of our smaller community, you know, three, as part of the larger community, whether it be a state, you know, then nation, then, you know, Western European imaginary, like these sort of varying veils are really invisible, you know? And so, you know, once we learn, I think, that everyone's right, you know, and somehow perhaps we'll realize that ours may not be better and that let's try to figure out a way for everyone to coexist or something. That's like not super well said, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. How should people experience this film? I was mentioning that at the top, how I did. But do you want people to stop trying to look for narratives and just kind of settle back like I did? Or do you want them looking for clues and stories? Do you tell them how to experience the film?
Well, I think I typically don't, mainly because I don't have a chance to, you know.
Yep.
But if I could, I would love to be able to ask people to just like relax and watch. It's not a film that you need to search, because you'll naturally be sort of searching inside yourself, I think. God, I would love to just be able to have everyone be like, you know, just here, take this Ambien, just kidding, and enjoy.
Ramel Ross, he's an assistant professor at Brown University. He directed, he wrote, produced, shot, and edited the film Hail County this evening, which is up for an Academy Award this Sunday night in the Best Documentary Feature category. The PBS program Independent Lens aired it last month, and it's now available to watch for free on their website. We have a link to it at radiowest.org. We spoke with Ross last year as a part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with Utah Film Center. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
We lived our little drama. We kissed in a field of white, and stars fell on Alabama last night.